Hello and welcome back to the Alpha Podcast. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined again by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm not too bad, thanks, John.
That's good. It's been a while since we last caught up, and the markets have continued their merry dance, which you've written about in your Alpha report this week. Perhaps we could discuss what the markets have been doing in a minute. There's a couple of companies that have updated this week. Which ones do you want to talk about today, Phil?
I think Tesco results quite interesting. I think there's a lot about not just results. I think there's a lot of questions now about what's the future direction of companies. I mean, you're always asking that of a business, but for some companies, I think it's coming to a head. And I think Tesco is one where you think, well, where does it go from here? I think also JD Sports quite interesting as well, what's going on there. I think the other one is, which I've written about this week, is Primark.
Sounds good. We'll come back to those in a minute. But for now, let's sort of start with a sort of 1,000-foot view of the markets and what they're doing. You asked the question, is it just too easy to make money from the markets? And it does seem that way at the moment. There seems to be a view that investing in equities is a one-way bet to profits. In fact, investing in many things at the moment, the view would be that it's a one-way street ever upwards. Are we being too complacent here? Are some people being too complacent here?
Yeah, possibly. In many ways, we're in the same boat as we have been for the last, I don't know, 5, maybe even 10 years, where, the returns on things like bonds are not worth having, even though bonds have actually done quite well up until maybe 6 months ago. And it's about shares. Shares are the one of the few places to put your money. And we've seen in the last year huge amounts of support being thrown at the stock market, being thrown at the economy. I think we've seen a lot of opportunistic flotations and a lot of, let's face it, a lot of greed, which is, what you tend to get when markets are, near the top. And you get absurd valuations put on companies with very, very questionable business models, if they have a business model at all. And it just, you see these things going up, people have this fear of missing out and they pile into it. But I think there is a widening disconnect between the value that the stock market puts on things and underlying business value or intrinsic value.
Is this just weight of money? Too much money chasing too few assets?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. I think if we look at if you look at the public equity markets, it's like a pond, and there are lots of people fishing in this pond, and there is only so many fish that you want to eat and therefore want to catch. And it is, and you're seeing a classic inflationary outcome, of lots of money chasing too little supply.
I mean, there has been a lot of talk recently of, this rotation, or in fact, we've seen evidence of a rotation from growth, which has been, powering ahead over the past year, or more, in fact, and value. I see, a lot of what's described as value as sort of rubbish, quite frankly. So it seems that the weight of money is now such that to justify putting it somewhere, we're even chasing stocks that are really quite bad companies in many cases. Yeah.
I mean, the problem with value is that you look at, you make the point about the quality of some of these businesses, and you're right. A lot of these businesses that are being touted as cheap are cheap for a reason, and they face they have, you know, very fragile business models, and they are going to struggle to grow their sales and their profits in the years ahead, and therefore become more valuable. So, you know, you can say that, you know, a share gets, or a business gets undervalued because of pessimism, and you can see that reverse. But once that process is reversed, if you haven't got the profit growth and the top line sales growth, where does the valuation go? I mean, I look at a lot of shares, you know, in the pub sector, hospitality sector, and some of them have seen very, very big recoveries in their share prices. But arguably, their business models have had a big bite taken out of them, and they'll come back, but they may not come back and make the same amount of money as they had in the past. Yet their share price has got quite close to where it was before all this kicked off.
Yeah, so basically, you know, if you're suggesting that a business should be valued based on the sort of long-term aggregation of its profits, then the valuation should be lower, given that it's going to take a very long time to recover to where it was before. You know, I mean, you say in your Alpha report this week that, you know, you're a bit old-fashioned. Has the way that, you know, the market, you know, has it changed? Should we change with it? Are we just wrong to be looking at these old-fashioned metrics?
Yes and no is the answer. I think that there's a lot of stuff that pastors conventional wisdom probably doesn't stand up to scrutiny anymore. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's sort of been in academic finance books, you know, particularly things like mean reversion, you know, valuations return to the mean. I think that the structure of economies and industries has changed so much that that's probably not going to happen. So to compare, you know, a valuation of a company with its history and argue that it's overvalued against history and will one day return to its historical average, I think that's out the window. I still think that, you know, the value of a company is, you know, how much cash you can strip out of it in the future. And of course, nobody knows that. It's all educated guesswork to some extent. I think that what's interesting, I mean, I'll go on about this separation between business value and stock market value. Now, what we've seen recently is we've seen, you know, investors identify themes that they think, business themes or industry themes, which they think are going to be winners, and they put their money into it. And if lots of other people do the same thing, they make a lot of money from it. But, that's what the stock market can give you. But if these businesses were private businesses and they were, you know, they weren't listed on the stock exchange, then, you know, it's difficult to argue that their prospects have changed as revenues when you look at the SPACs of the world. And I just think it's showing almost, well, probably it is showing an excessive risk appetite, and that risk appetite can get rewarded in the short term, but, you know, you want to basically, it's like being on a runaway train that's heading for the cliff, and you got to think you're smart enough to jump off this. It's very interesting. Before I just came on this call with you, I was just looking through my Twitter feed, and on this Twitter feed was an example of something that's been written about a diner in America that has $35,000 of revenue, and its shares are listed on the stock exchange. It has a market capitalization of over $100 million, or around that kind of figure. And you just think, you know, what's going on here? You know, you scratch your head and just think, well, what's that? And, but you can scratch your head on lots of other things as well. And whilst the momentum, though, whilst there is a crowd effect in these kind of investments, it will go and go and go. You know, we saw this 20 years ago. It can go a lot further than you think, but eventually it will stop, and it will be, you know, it will be a mess when it ends.
I mean, you could argue that crowd effect is having a similar impact in sort of other assets as well. Bitcoin, you talk about in your Alpha report. We talked about it a lot in the magazine. House prices, which are the subject of this week's cover feature. I mean, you know, certainly looking at affordability ratios for residential property in the UK, they are as high as they have ever been. People simply can't afford houses. Bitcoin, I have no idea what it's trading at now, but it's still going up and seems unstoppable. I mean, is this all the crowd effect?
I think Bitcoin is a crowd effect. I think house pricing is another matter, and that's just really about putting money and putting borrowed money in buyers' pockets. And you know, we are in a situation with the UK economy in particular, where for the last 30 to 40 years, the government of the day's go-to policy to stimulate the economy is to stimulate house pricing. And it's either done by relaxing credit, lowering interest rates, support schemes, subsidies, stamp duty, and so on. And the wealth effect from property is significant. And, you know, you just have to walk around your neighbourhood for the last few years. And, you know, even now, just look at the amount of scaffolding that's up there. Look at the number of skips in drives with, you know, old bathrooms and old kitchen bits in it. And you know, some of that is funded by, you know, trading down by older generation, which is a form of equity extraction. But all of it is just done by tagging onto the mortgage. And they can do that because of the wealth effect. And I was interested, you know, Travis Perkins this week put out their trading statement, you know, builder's merchant and owner of Toolstation. And, you know, they're saying that, you know, the repairs and maintenance and improvement market is booming, absolutely booming.
We put some calls in yesterday to try and get some work done. And we were told it was 12 weeks before we could get a carpenter on site to even give us a quote. Such is the level of demand.
Yeah. And you're beginning to see, the interesting thing is you're beginning to see signs of raw material inflation as well now. And, you know, Travis Perkins alluded to this yesterday or the day before. Things like timber inflation, steel inflation, copper inflation. Now, these are, you know, quite big inputs that go into building houses. And whilst you know, builders will have hedged some of these costs, you know, if the selling price doesn't rise to offset that, then you're going to get a margin squeeze. But the government's just playing a very dangerous game with house pricing, and it's making, you know, it's pricing more and more people out of the market, or getting more and more people, particularly young people, to take on bigger and bigger amounts of debt. And there's a lot of focus on the interest rate, but it's not just the interest rate. It's the fact you've got to pay the loan back. You know, I borrow £1 million from you at 0%. I've still got to repay you £1 million. Now, if I'm earning 30 grand a year, or just over that, which is the average wage, or just under that, which is the average wage in this country, that's not an easy thing to do. In fact, it's an impossible thing to do. So, you know, but there's, you know, we've talked about this for the last 20 years. You know, house prices disconnected with earnings about 20 years ago. And, you know, the justifications for it in terms of dual income, lower interest rates, have just pushed things higher and higher. And after the financial crisis, you know, you saw countries like Ireland, where you actually saw a correction in house pricing. The government here did absolutely nothing to let the market, you know, you're supposed to have a government and governments that believe in free markets. But when it comes to house prices, it doesn't believe in free markets because it believes that prices should only go up. And it will use huge amounts of money and other people's money, your money, my money, to underwrite the value of property, which creates, you know, I don't want to go off on this, but, you know, things like intergenerational divide, you know, and things like that. It's, you know, a very serious issue that lots of people have written about, but doesn't really get sort of get swept under the carpet. But it's a massive problem because you see the wealth effect on things like property. And, you know, you see people trading up to try and get a bigger and bigger exposure to the property market. But I think very few of them actually ask the question, who are they going to sell their houses to in 10, 15, 20 years' time when the generation beneath them, large amounts of them, are priced out of the market? They're not even on the ladder, let alone have sufficient equity to trade up.
Indeed. So where then is the wealth effect for that generation that are struggling now to get on the housing ladder? I mean, I do think there is a crowd effect here because, you know, sort of we are encouraged from a very early age to get on the housing ladder. It's a very British thing. It's something that everyone is encouraged to do. And it seems to be that, you know, there is this, like, get on the housing ladder at any price mentality creeping. And that feels like the stock market too, or Bitcoin. Get in at any price because otherwise you'll miss out. I find it terribly troubling. I think we mentioned the word casino before we started recording. Yeah. But no, in terms of the levels of risk people are taking, it does feel like that at times.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's always about, you know, you mentioned risk and everyone, you know, the huge focus that you see, you know, either talking to people or reading what people are putting, it's all focused on how much money they're making. No one ever goes back to these people. I see very few people say, you know, so yeah, I'm up, you know, my portfolio's up and I'm up X percent and I've owned this and it's up. Yeah, but look at the risk you took to buy it. You know, you bought a small cap illiquid share that just happened to have lots of other people buying it as well. But if that had gone the other way, you would have been very quiet on this and gone off to nurse your losses. And, you know, we talk about, we measure up fund managers and investors measure themselves against each other on returns that they make. But the proper way to evaluate anything is look at the returns that you've made against the risks you've put yourself in front of or taken on to make those returns. And in a lot of cases, the big money is being made by taking big risks. Now, that's fine. You know, you're getting paid for the risk, but, you know, a flip of a coin or a change in the wind direction and those big gains can become big losses.
It feels like a very sort of short-term mentality that's creeping in now. How much can you make as quickly as possible? And, you know, that for me has never been what investing in the stock market should be about. I mean, you mentioned themes earlier. And, you know, themes are interesting. You know, the sort of electrification of the world, EVs, you know, green energy, e-commerce, AI. You know, all these things will have an impact. But I think I wrote about this a few months ago, you know, I think it was Bill Gates or something like, we overestimate the change that's going to happen in 1 year and underestimate what's going to happen in 10. So I think there's a lot of overestimation of what's going to happen very quickly with a lot of these very speculative investments. But they are going to have an impact, just it's going to take much longer.
Yeah, but you see, there's a lot of people with a vested interest in peddling these stories for financial gain. And, you know, we come back to risk again. You know, you ask yourself the question, you know, some of these new technologies and new themes, some of them are going to be winners. They're going to be transformative. They're going to create massive amounts of wealth. A lot of them won't. And I think, you know, I sort of wonder whether, you know, whether these kind of investments should be freely available on the stock market. You know, these are the kind of things that, you know, may in the past, and I know there's still a bit of it, but largely would have been done off market. They may have been, you know, venture capital funded. And that kind of thing. And whilst allowing people to get in at the sort of development phase on the public markets can be welcome because you're allowed to have the huge potential wealth gain. You have the risk that goes with it as well, and you know the concern is that there will be lots of people who use their sort of instinctive desire to make money quickly and end up taking a risk that they really can't afford to take on.
I mean, the VC comparison is interesting because, you know, the sort of basic principle of VC is that, you know, 9 out of 10, and that's being generous, of your investments are going to fail. And so that to be a successful VC early stage investor, you have to make dozens of investments in the hope that one of them may succeed and cover the losses you make on all the others. And private investors can't afford to do that. Generally speaking, which I think is the danger in, as you say, in making them available.
I agree. But it goes back to the question that you asked me initially is, you know, has the way that we invest changed? You know, and I think it has. I think in the last few years, we've seen a lot more focus on finding the next big winner. I mean, that's always gone on, but I think it's become a lot more public. And I think, you know, you look at the success of funds like, you know, Scottish Mortgage Trust, who have taken big bets on business models, and some, you know, quite a lot of them have paid off.
But they've got a big portfolio, so that, you know, there's a very long tail of investments in that. That is the VC model.
Yeah, they've got a big portfolio, and they've got a lot of diligent people working on this every day of the week. That doesn't protect them from losing money, but it limits the risk. They know what they're buying into. But yes, I think the reason is because a lot of investors, quite rightly, look what's on the menu, you know, in places like the FTSE 100, for example, and they think, well, I don't fancy that much. I'll have something a bit more spicy. And of course there's been plenty of people willing to dish them up something, you know, to satisfy that need.
Yeah, well, let's hope it isn't too hot for them. Should we talk about something that's really not spicy, the sort of chicken korma of the investment world, which is Tesco?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's had a pretty good pandemic, really. I mean, under the circumstances, I mean, it's not exactly flown, but it's holding its own and it's in a good shape. But I guess the big question, which takes the spice out of it, is where does it go from here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's already the biggest, and it has been the biggest UK. I mean, essentially now this has now become, you know, it's a UK business again. They've got out of Asia, they've got a business in Central Europe, but most of the money is being made out of the UK supermarket business now. And they have lost a bit of market share. You know, they were over 30% of the market. They're now high 20s. It's difficult to see how the cake gets bigger at Tesco, which is a bit of a shame because I think arguably this business is, as far as a customer is concerned, in the best position it's been for at least 10 years, arguably more. You know, the Tesco now, walking around Tesco, and I do the weekly family shop. I still go to the supermarket. I still go to Tesco. And I went back to Tesco about 2 years ago, and I've tried others like Morrisons and Sainsbury's. And I just feel that you can see it as a customer. If you're a kind of person like me who sort of looks out for these kind of things, you can see the things going on in terms of value, in-store service, tills and all that kind of stuff. Really, really good. You know, the initiatives that are going on in things like club card pricing, Aldi price matching, club card plus, you know, families can save a lot of money shopping in Tesco. May not be cheaper than Aldi or Lidl, but it's the the price effect is very, very powerful. And you've seen that Tesco has been taking share off its bigger competitors. The problem is that the market itself isn't really growing that much, and it's moved away from supermarkets to online, and the profit available online is not the same as it is in store. And Tesco's online sales boomed last year, and they said that it's making a profit, but they didn't tell us how much, which makes you think that it isn't very much. And you know, you're going to get some recovery in profits over the next couple of years because they spent nearly £900 million on making their stores COVID compliant. The bank lost money. Tesco Bank lost money because of bad loans. That should swing back to profit. But you just start thinking, once that's got back, and you know, you've got the catering sales that come back at Booker, where's the growth? And I don't think there is any. But what you're left with is a very, very well run, highly profitable, highly cash generative business. I think the dividend yield on it is over 4%. And, you know, we've seen Asda taken out. Tesco is obviously a bigger meal, but it wouldn't surprise me if, pension funds, private equity have a look at this and think, yeah, this is the kind of investment that we can financially engineer and make a lot of money out of.
Almost sort of bond proxy like in a phrase that I haven't heard for quite a while. That does make sense. And you've seen, obviously, the Qatari Investment Authority took a big stake in Sainsbury's some years ago. I can't remember if they still have it. And there's stake building going on at Sainsbury's as well by a Czech investor, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know, maybe the sector is in play, as it were. If there's no growth, it makes sense.
Yeah, there's always, if there's no growth, what can we do with the, I'm being unkind saying financial engineering, but that's what it is, you know. Sell off the property. I mean, Tesco's done a lot of sale and lease back of its stores. It's actually been buying back some of its freeholds. But, you know, there will be investors. And I think one of the main reasons of the Asda deal was the property backing, and all the quoted supermarkets have got big property backing to their businesses. And I it's been talked, this is not anything new, but I think that in a world where, you know, the risk reward trade off at the other end of the market looks quite unappealing to a lot of people, this part of the market could spark a bit of interest, I think.
Yeah, dull but worthy. Dull but worthy. Yeah. Should we talk about JD to finish off? So again, it's another successful British retailer. Sells trainers and produced some really good numbers over the last year. But again, the outlook is a bit of a worry. What are your concerns here?
I've got concerns, but I think JD might still do okay. The big concern here is the relationship between the big branded sportswear companies and retailers like JD. The pandemic has, accelerated the trend towards online selling. And, brands like Nike and Adidas are increasingly trying to cut out the middleman in terms of the retailer and sell direct to the consumer, and they've got the resources, the branding to do that. And I've no doubt that JD have had a look at this, and they mentioned this in their results statement. The chairman makes this statement about the changing way of this market, and I think it explains a great deal of what's been going on at JD Sports the last few years, in that they've been buying up. You know, they've gone into America and they've made an acquisition a few years ago, which now looks really, really good. And they've then made another couple of acquisitions. They're now trying to make an acquisition into Eastern Europe, which is somewhere where they don't have a lot of representation. And what they're trying to do is build a global scale, or scale in the markets that matter, so that the big shoe manufacturers, sports fashion manufacturers, can't ignore them. And I think they're probably going to succeed.
I mean, they always said, you know, their strategy was to be like the one big retail partner that, you know, as others sort of drop by the wayside, as these big trainer manufacturers do go direct to consumer. I mean, they're buying a lot of shops. So you know, we talk about an online world, but really what they have is a physical footprint. It's massive. Yeah. And, you know, maybe this is a market where their sort of direct to consumer isn't as, you know, overwhelming as it perhaps is in some areas. And people like to go to the shops to try on a pair of shoes. It's quite interesting that it sort of flies against the sort of conventional thinking we currently are being encouraged to have around e-commerce.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that the physical bricks and mortars retailers that have got the brand. So, you know, JD, Primark is another one, but for different reasons. If you have what JD has done, you know, it has, particularly in young people, has basically got the message into people's heads that its stores are the place to go to buy your kit. And, you know, you look at what it's done in America, if you've got teenage kids, you understand JD Sports a little bit, and you see what they've done here. I mean, you see how they Sports Direct gave it a helping hand, but let's be honest. And JD Sports took full advantage of that in the UK. But you look what it's done in America. You know, it's bought this business called Finish Line a few years ago. It's converted the Finish Line stores into JD, and customers love them. And so they have a really good connection with the customers. And I think this is their key asset, and I think that it's very hard to compete with, and it means that they're part of the ecosystem and a very big part of it. And athleisure sports fashion is a big growth market. All the clothing retailers are looking to get into it, and this is probably one of the best plays that you can have on it.
Does Chetters don't look too expensive either? I mean, there is this risk factor, which I guess, you know, all investors, potential investors in JD should be aware of, but the shares don't look too expensive. And if you're right, and that it has built, you know, bought its way into the into an unassailable position in that ecosystem, then that seems reasonable. 20 times 2023 earnings.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've got to consider people like, you know, companies like Amazon here. But I don't, you know, Amazon, a lot of people buy trainers through Amazon. But Amazon hasn't got the same specific marketing in this market that is connecting with this one type of customer. So I think, you know, a lot of retailers in America have been struggling against Amazon, and I think the fact that JD's gone in there and bought a retailer that was on its knees, and, you know, has turned it around and is now looking very healthy with it, shows you what a good retailer this company is.
Mm. Also shows you that shops are not dead, which is a theme that a lot of people have been betting indiscriminately on. You mentioned Primark as well. You know, it being one of the big brands whose shops people love coming back to. What were your views there? You mentioned it's slightly different. What were you thinking when you said that?
Well, it's not targeting one specific, you know, section of the fashion market like JD is. It's just got a unbelievably impressive business model, and there's a lot of criticisms against these kind of retailers, the fast fashion, and I think some of those criticisms are well made, but the fact of the matter is, unless you're paying lots of money for, you know, upmarket bespoke fashion, You know, even if you buy, you know, a pair of Levi's, it's made in Turkey or Pakistan or Bangladesh, and is sold at a lot higher margin than what Primark's doing. And I think that they're trying to address certain things. Whether that time will tell whether they're doing it right, but what they have is this: they just have a brand that people love. And you know, you look at it, compare it with Next. And, you know, you look at the volume that, you know, Next is moving from stores to online. But, you know, the difference in the amount of volume that Primark is shifting vis-a-vis Next and the profits they're still able to make from it is incredible. And I think that there's still a lot of rollout potential on Primark, particularly, I mean, they're very bullish about markets like France, Spain, Italy, but also Eastern Europe. And then there's the American side to it, which is, well, we'll see. But also things like places like, you know, small UK towns, market towns, you know, they can go into places like this and they just clear up. Now, clearly, you know, people won't be happy. A lot of people won't be happy about that, but they do very well. And it's just an incredibly well-run business. You know, in terms of the buying, their ability to market stuff that people want and sell, and they keep coming back and buying. You know, there are some issues which I won't go into here, but generally speaking, this is a business model that has still got legs, in my view, because it just offers outstanding value, and it's very, very hard to compete against the way it set itself up.
How important is, I mean, it's obviously important, but in terms of sort of the overall ABF investment case, you know, how much will we be looking at Primark when we're thinking about buying ABF shares?
Oh, it's key, isn't it? You know, I mean, I'm not.
But to the extent, sure, to the extent where we can ignore everything else because it's all about Primark.
It pretty much is all about Primark. I mean, they've got a really good grocery business there. They've got some quite good grocery brands, you know, like Twinings, Ovaltine, Ryvita, Jordan Cereals, that kind of thing. They've got a big bread business as well, which is a bit iffy. I'm not sure you can make a lot of money selling bread these days. Certainly not, you know, stuff you put in the toaster. But that's doing really well. I'm not sure I want to own, and there's not a lot of value in, you know, food ingredients or animal feed and that kind of stuff. So it is largely about Primark. But I think the grocery business is worth a lot of money. And I think if you look at the value that's being put on similar businesses to Primark, like Hennes and Maritz, TJX in America, then AB Foods shares look cheap if you believe that and back that out. And, you know, the thing is about this is that it has a business model that can compete against online, because it's not, you know, it hasn't got an online business, but it uses the internet very effectively to market its brand, and then uses it, and it's been very, very good. One of the underappreciated things about Primark is how it's created a store environment that people want to go to. And, you know, you look at the kind of stuff that it's selling, it just doesn't stack up to sell, you know, £2, £3 T-shirt online when, you know, the delivery, to make money on delivery, you've got to charge twice as much as the T-shirt. But you look at the stores and you look at the volume that people buy, and it stacks up really well.
And I think we saw people queuing on Monday, 2 hours before Primark opens, to get in there. I think JD had queues out. These shops, maybe our investment case should be built on mad people queuing outside of shops at the crack of dawn. Phil, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you, as always.
That's all right, John. Good to talk to you as well.
And thank you all for listening. And we will be back again next week. Thank you.